So this episode features my good friend Kylie Payne. In it, we discuss some interesting topics dealing with the current state of the creative industry and getting taken advantage of as a worker. And we draw from experiences working together. We talk about some problems with the economy and what it means to be a creative now. And just kind of go over some of these emergent things that are happening now in a information age economy. In this episode that we recorded, I met him at a coffee shop, and we just sat outside and we just talked. So you're going to hear kind of an electrical hum in the background, so it's pretty persistent, but I've done what I could to get rid of the noise, so I apologize, you know, for that hum, but it's kind of hard to escape it, you know, if you really just kind of sit and listen, especially, you know, if you're in a city, it's impossible to just, you know, find somewhere that's totally silent. You'll always hear the hum of something, whether it be the electrical grid or nature or just whatever. I mean, you know, as long as I think there's form, there can never be silence. As long as there's form, there can never be silence, I think. Everything, I think, is always, when you go down to it at the minuscule level, it's moving, it's vibrating. Nothing is ever really static. And I think that produces a type of sound. It may not be, you may not be able to pick it up with just your ears. You may need to have a type of instrument that could pick it up, or, you know, with radios receiving electromagnetic spectrum from space. This type of chaotic randomness is all around us, and I think that we have to deal with it. And it's really quite pleasant. It really is, to me. It's, I mean, we can hear. That is an extremely powerful sense that we have. I was sitting outside, and I heard somebody blowing like a, they were mowing their lawn, and, I just, you know, that the loud motor to me, at first when I heard it, I thought of, my mind went to, you know, somewhere. It was just like, when I heard it, I, thought it was the sound of death, because you're killing life, you're cutting grass, and you're killing life. It's really strange when you think about that, you know, when you're cutting grass, you're killing. When you're cutting grass, you're killing the life, you're killing grass, and you're killing bugs and everything. An untamed garden is a lot more appealing to me than a tamed garden. I like a little bit of diversity. So to me, I was listening to that motor going off, and I just thought that that's the sound of death. But then I realized, well, that was just my brain making that connection there. So I was just trying to listen to the sound without any judgment on it. Just perceiving this horrible... just perceiving. But maybe that's bullshit. Maybe you can't separate sense from an aesthetic judgment or whatever. I don't know. But maybe you can. What I'm trying to say is that static's been around forever. We're going to have to deal with it. And here's the podcast episode, so I hope you enjoy it. Alright, we're recording. So, I have here with me Kylie Payne.
Hey, everyone.
And we're just going to be basically talking about some stuff concerning labor, the economy, and just, you know, just kind of general rapping about that. We want to talk about some personal experiences we've had. We both worked in creative industries, I guess, in a way. So.
And we've, you know, employed at the same place for a time. Small business that certainly bent its fair share of the rules.
Yeah. So, how so? Give some examples. Like, what happened?
Oh man, like the as time goes on, the more like the worse it looks, I guess.
Well, for one, we simply were not paid enough, and I think that we did some stuff that might have been considered, you know, dangerous. We didn't get proper certification to work with some certain tools.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, didn't get training for equipment that needed training for.
And the majority of the people that did work there only worked there for a very short time. So
Yeah,
it was
high
a
turnover rate.
very high turnover rate. That seems to kind of be the norm when you're talking about people going out and getting, you know, work in creative industries. Why do you think that there is this, you know, a lot of the work is very, you know, short term, benefit free. Why is that? What do you think?
Well, I guess you could attack that from several different angles, but what I'm gonna go with right now is just speaking from personal experience. I guess just a different worldview that doesn't align with that of employers, perhaps. Because for me, I guess, you know, that the profit motive isn't the bottom line for me. I'm not doing this because the money that it's going to bring me. I'm doing it because it's something that I enjoy, it's something that I want to pursue and, you know, perfect and hone my craft in this trade or area, whatever you want to
And
call it.
for those of you who don't know, we're talking about working with cameras. We're both, you know, photographers and, you know,
Videographers.
videographers. So yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. And also did some graphic design. So we're basically just going over the propensity for people to be taken advantage of in those areas.
And because, you know, I think it does sort of fall into a bit of a trade or whatever is what it would be called, because it's like you can go out and get a four-year degree in like graphic design or something like that, but or you know, there's probably like two-year certification programs, or like even just getting the programs yourselves and then learning it in the freelancing. So there's a lot of different sort of like papers that you can get to sort of show that you're capable and, you know,
Right.
legitimate in doing this. And so that sort of affects the market. You know, I'm not an economist, don't have that sort of background, so, but yeah, I can speculate.
Do you think that there's like that there is this, you know, idea that because we're doing something maybe creative, that automatically gets valued less? It's not seen as not being
Yeah,
as
because
important.
it's an abstract. You're producing a good that is based within, you know, people's heads. You're not, yeah, actually, you know, you're branding, creating an image. You know, it's how people perceive what you're doing, or how they perceive your product, but yeah, it's still something that's not tangible, and so it's, I guess, a lot easier to negotiate the price of that.
Why does it seem like there's more opportunities to freelance in this field?
Because again, like, you know, people can just pick up the programs, and I go, that's, you know, what we did really is just got a hold of Photoshop and like other programs, and then just started working on them, and you know, started out, you know, self-taught, and then have gone and gotten actual education in these fields, and so we have sort of have that combined like book knowledge and real-world experience, and but yeah, you know, different people have different backgrounds, and so they. And also, I guess it's cheaper to outsource the labor rather than having like an in-house
Exactly.
art team or whatever put to assemble. It's cheaper to just outsource it to somebody else.
I think that yes, it is cheaper to outsource, and also there's less liability involved by picking up people that are just there for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. There's less liability.
And then you don't have to maintain a good working relationship with this person, because if you're not planning on working with them for very long, then, you know, you treat them like a disposable resource. And that shows, there's a Tumblr that I follow called Clients From Hell that shares a lot of stories of, you know, people like dealing with horrible encounters of clients who just disagreeable.
Exactly, because like you said, we are dealing with, like, people who work in this field are dealing with, like, abstracts, and so that there's this, you know, it's not valued in the same way as, like, somebody who may be an engineer is valued. I think, you know, in a way that kind of comes out of it's all based on, you know, the societal perspective that you're viewing it in, I think.
I guess a specific and personal example for me would be, it's like, my job, I thought today was going to be the last day of my job, but they're having me work tomorrow, too. I was not too happy about that. I was planning on getting to stay up late tonight, but no.
Tomorrow night.
And so anyways, for a short time longer, it is my job to go onto job sites and document the construction. And my job is perceived differently than like the people that I'm interacting with on the job site, who are doing the physical manual labor, and my walking from room to room and taking pictures. Since I'm not actually moving anything and you know, changing the environment in any way, they're not perceiving what I'm doing as real work.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's the idea that what you're doing isn't real work, because you're doing something that may be perceived as easy. Photography isn't easy, you know. That's the idea of it, you know, a false necessity right there. It's saying that this is needed more than this. You know, these concrete real things are needed more than these abstracts. But anyways, go ahead.
That pretty much is the point that I was trying to make, is that since I'm not physically changing, you know, or like producing anything that they can see, and they don't see it as, you know, real work, or they always, I guess, would, you know, make assertions to how, like, you know, I've got a lofty job or a good job. I've been called easy money. I thought that was pretty funny. I was perceived differently because I held a camera and a clipboard. And, you know, once people actually got to talking to me, and I would just, you know, be lighthearted. And a lot of these people are, open up with a sarcastic remark. And as long as you're able to throw one right back and just show that you're on the same page, like, you know, I've never had an issue with anybody. So
right. Okay.
I just showed them that, like, hey, man, I'm working just like everybody else, so.
It's interesting, because, like, when you do that, you kind of have to, you have to engage yourself in this almost kind of, just kind of, like, put yourself in the mindset, you know, you have to kind of speak their language mm-hmm. in order to get along. And I guess that's, you know, how you different cultures have to, you know, when they got to learn how to work together, you know? Because you wouldn't normally act like that outside of work,
mm-hmm.
but you're going into work, you're kind of having to force that upon yourself.
And I heard something earlier coming here on the radio, making a reference to Moby Dick, and just like, I guess comparing like New York to, you know, like being like how on a whaling ship you've got all these different people from different places, and now just sort of like, you know, they're aware of where they came from from before, but now that they're on the ship, like, they're all off the ship. And I guess, you know, that is sort of part of the experience I've seen, like, on job sites. It's like people just are working. It's like there's a job to be done, and that's, like, what has to be done, and people just sort of put out other things, or at least for the most part, and then obviously there's stuff that goes on when they're no longer working. You know, they're wearing a different hat.
Yeah. But I guess, yeah, going back to the whole thing about, you know, some labor being better than others, mm-hmm. That's not a good mindset to have, because it divides us. It's saying that, rather than saying that, you know, all labor is essentially equal in some way, it's saying that there's certain labor that's better than the others. Because, you know, we used to work with this one guy who would, like, he had the idea that, you know, building things and engineering is, like, you know, the best type of labor there is. He would kind of, you know, poke fun at us when we were doing our, you know, graphic arts type mm-hmm. stuff, and saying, like, you know, hey, that looks easy or whatever. That's not. So, but it's like, I mean, you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
It's this, and I think that is, that's what kind of divides us. It's not unifying us in a way, because the whole kernel of the machine is basically just labor. That's what drives it, no mm-hmm. matter what type. But, so, you know, we've had our personal experiences with that. How do we, what are some ways that we could do better, or fight back? How are there ways to organize? Because, I mean, I don't know, are there unions for, I'm sure there are, but...
I think there's, like, a photographer's guild or something like that. That may be
not in America, but it seems pretty prestigious,
though. Yeah. I don't know. I guess,
don't sell yourself. Yeah.
You know, get together with other people and then, you know, pull resources and, you know, help each other, because, you know, if you've got a community of people doing the same thing, then, and if everybody's, like, going to learn from one another, and then, you know, you benefit from it in the long run. Like, everybody gets further when they're helping each other out rather than pulling each other down.
Exactly. Exactly. There needs to be some way for people to have leverage against, you know, the employers. Like, you know, one thing that you can do is just simply, like, don't sell yourself short. Don't do it. Because that's, like, isn't, like, TaskRabbit works on, like, a bidding system, correct? Or it used to.
It did.
But in a way, it was literally people kind of, like, auctioning off their labor, correct? Mm-hmm. So it kind of functioned like an eBay of labor.
Do you want to, like, introduce what TaskRabbit is or was, or...?
Yeah, TaskRabbit is kind of like this online mobile marketplace where, like, employers can kind of select, you know, people that can do certain tasks.
You would compare it to sort of... like one of the rideshare websites.
What is that? What is the name of that?
Mine's drawing a blank right now, because they're talking about coming to Birmingham.
Does it start with a U?
No, Uber. That's
not, yeah, Uber. That's
yeah,
it.
I don't know why I was drawing a blank, because I've been talking about it a lot. But so it just, like, allows you to, on your own time, like, you know, you create your own hours. It's, you know, you can make as much money as you want to, I guess, is the model or whatever. And yeah, you would bid, you know, whoever, you know, would say they could do it for the lowest price, they would get to do it. And now they've changed it to where it's like you're automatically assigned a task, and if you don't take it within, like, 20 minutes, they pass it on to somebody else. Yeah. And, you don't get to determine your price. There's, like, a fixed price now, and, or something like that.
You have to go through a application process, and when you're doing these jobs, you have to wear a uniform, so there's more regulation.
Oh, was there a uniform beforehand, or is that
new? I don't think it's new. But I know, I was reading, like, a lot of...
Like, you have to dress like an actual rabbit. Like, you're big Easter Bunny
But, I was reading that different... or a lot of TaskRabbits are coming together in Facebook groups, and they're talking to each other. So, it seems like there is this desire to collectivize, mm-hmm. but the face of unions have to kind of change now, you know? It doesn't have to be... same.
We could I wonder if they could use the social media model.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. Just like create, like, you know, a Facebook for that, you know, a union, and they'd be able to, you know, talk that away.
And, mm-hmm. And they're already doing that, and that kind of stuff just kind of existing. It's like people are engaging in dialogue now. But there are several problems with a system like that, or, you know, emerging into what might be called a gig economy, which is like this prevalence of, you know, low-paying,
temporary,
mainly unskilled labor. The way I see that is that what really drives that is that something like TaskRabbit is taking, you know, a lot of trivial problems, and they're solving those trivial problems with more trivial tasks and trivial jobs.
Well, it seems
jobs.
Like it's just like it's the thin line between, like, what we can't automate yet and what already has been automated.
It just seems like it's trying to solve a problem, but in doing so, it's just kind of
creating more problems.
In a way, it's kind of like this.
Because it's trying to, it's like, you know, if you keep pouring on more and more, like, you know, like asphalt on a road that has like a pothole, and it's just gonna keep sinking in unless you, like, you fix the you know, the problem. It's just gonna keep, like, sagging in on itself. So you gotta address the root of the cause.
Right, and like we'll get to the root problems like later, but like it, but like with this right here, you know, with something like TaskRabbit or like the gig economy or just like searching for jobs on Craigslist, it's creating, you know, you're having all these trivial things that are being brought on because of automation, because of a certain degree of free time that we, you know, people may have. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, people need to work out there. I could take all these trivial things that are presented in modern life, like, you know, help me blow up balloons or something, or just something weird, like help me wrap 43, you know, something or other. And it's saying, okay.
Unload a truck.
Or unload a truck. You know, all these essentially just created problems are being solved with, you know, menial and trivial tasks. That's what really gets me about it. A lot of this stuff is very trivial. A lot of the labor is very trivial and unskilled. So where does that put people? It marginalizes people that want to have more long-term and meaningful work. That's a problem. That is a problem. That's a major problem. There are other problems there that are a little more concrete, like, you know, no benefits. You know, you don't get any benefits. Healthcare coverage.
That's true.
You know, what if you get sick? You're marginalized. The fact of the matter is, I think that we're more concerned with, you know, scratching the surface of every facet of society with a way to kind of include, like, because, yeah, you're saying, like, we're trying to automate everything, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of asking, like...
Like,
yeah.
I guess one of the, it's like what I took away... from, like, Society of the Spectacles book I read a couple years ago,
right,
back when I was in college, was like that, you know, what capitalism tries to do is it alienates you from something that you already had a connection to, and then it tries to sell it back to you in you know, small increments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like, rather than asking a neighbor, and he's like, hey, can you feed my dog while I'm out of town next week? It's like, no, you gotta go and apply on a website and give your personal information away, and then, like, you know, pay somebody that you don't know to come to your house to feed your dog while you're
gone.
You
know what's scary is that some people may never know that those days have existed, mm-hmm. because TaskRabbit, I was reading on their Wikipedia page that TaskRabbit kind of bills themselves as, like, neighbors helping neighbors. It doesn't act like that, you know, it's not, it's this more, capitalist way of going about it, because, like I was saying, it's taking these problems and it's solving them under a capitalist mindset. It's mm-hmm. not. It's kind of, and I'm gonna diverge off of this for a little bit and, like, go into something of, like, environmentalism. It's like, you know, we're presented with the problem of, you know, we're kind of destroying, you know, a lot of species, and the Earth is going through, you know, a big extinction right now, but we're kind of taking that and turning it to the language of sustainable development. Like, how can we continue operating under a capitalist mindset but still be sustainable, rather than saying, this is our home, this is the earth, this is...
How can we create the slowest torture possible to before we just...
It doesn't seem like we're addressing the real root of the problem. Part of it, you know, makes me just kind of, I don't know. I don't think that we have a face yet for any other system. It's like everything is just lumped into just one way of solving things. It's through capitalism. If you want to make a difference, go do a tech startup or whatever. There's no other option there. You know, there's like, can I, you know, because it doesn't have a face yet. I don't know. But, so we're entering into a gig economy. And were you going to say something? Gig economy. We're entering into a gig economy.
Drawing a blank at the moment.
That word, gig, is just it's a strange word.
You know where it comes from?
I have no idea.
No, neither do I.
Gig? Come to think of it, job is kind of a weird word, too. I don't know.
Career?
Okay, that's a good point. Career is kind of like is different from a job in that it's more kind of, would you say
long-term.
That it's more long-term?
That's like retirement. Like you get retirement from a career.
Can you have a career with TaskRabbit? Or being a TaskRabbit? It's more associated with your identity, and that's an interesting thing. It's like, if a career is more associated with your identity, it's harder to get a career started
Then, like,
now.
There's all this, you know, with social media, you know, it's like this idea of, like, you know, self-image and, like, branding and, like, you know, viewing yourself as a brand and, like, putting yourself out there as, like, you know, how marketable can you be? It's like, oh, no, that just sounds awful.
Yeah. Pretty bad. Okay, so what are some more problems with something like, you know, a gig economy or TaskRabbit?
I guess just another problem I see, like, and again, I guess this, you know, could come through the alienation as well, but just there's a lack of accountability, I guess. Because again, you know, with TaskRabbit, it's like, you know, you don't, I guess there isn't you're giving somebody a temporary position doing something that somebody could have had, an actual job from before, like, you know, something, you know, there's like, you know, maid services.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're just getting somebody to come in and vacuum your house once a week and dust a little, then that changes things. And, you know, people can just say, oh, it's a disruptive technology, and this is the way that the future is, and, like, you know, the old way just has to adapt. But again, like, you know, I think there's, I guess, a level of accountability there that's being lost with the new way. And I guess I don't know how TaskRabbit structures its, like, you know, legally, like, you know, are these people, like, you know, would TaskRabbit be held responsible, or would the individual be held responsible if something were to go awry?
I don't know. That's interesting. I don't think that, you know, I'm suspicious of models such as TaskRabbit being like the forerunners and what's, you know, what labor is going to look like. I do think, however, that labor is going to be populated by, you know, a lot of just unskilled, low-paying jobs. It's going to kind of cut out the middle there, you know. I think part of that is being caused by several things that I'll go into later, but...
You know, if you got people doing menial tasks and they don't really have a passion for, or you know, a lot of experience or just, like, it's just something that they have to do to get by, then it's not going to be as productive as, you know, it could be.
Unless we
if
make
they
them
were
feel passionate.
How do you do that?
Isn't there like a an ice cream shop that makes their employees sing or something? I saw it on a King of the Hill episode. I don't know.
I mean, there's a lot of that. And there's, it's like a lot of rules and the, I guess, service industry. It's like, it's all about how you're being perceived. You're selling yourself.
You're selling your time. You're selling your time and your labor, which is, you know.
Selling your image in some cases, or even, I guess, parts of your identity. Especially, like, you know, if you begin to relate with your position at work, like, you begin to see yourself as that position. It's like
that's a little dangerous, because that you're going to lose connection with something even more deeper, which, you know, can never be found through a career or through a job or through, you know, any type of labor such as that.
I guess something else I'd be interested to bring up is, I guess, the snafu principle is something that Robert Anton Wilson wrote.
What is that?
That's, you know, the more links in a chain that you have, the more removed the people at the top are. So, you know, the military is where that, you know, snafu, that term originates from. And so it's like, you know, private on the ground reports something, and then by the time it makes its way up to, you know, the general at the top, it's the story's completely, it's like a game of telephone.
I was fixing to say, it's a game of telephone. It's like a game of, a giant game of telephone.
Because you're always going to try to please the person above you, and so you're going to phrase it in the way that you think that, you know, is going to give them the best reaction, and so... You know, yeah, by the time it gets the way up to the top, it's like they're so removed that they never learn the truth about what's going on around them.
I see.
And so, you know, part of the reason why our leaders are so incompetent is because it's like they are so insulated by the bureaucracy around them that like they don't get to experience.
People want to please them, I see, which can kind of distort the information.
Mitt Romney goes into a grocery store and it's like, oh... He turns into Hank Hill.
There was, like, an article about, like, was it, like, Mitt Romney, like, going into a grocery store and him, like, people were just saying, like, he was acting very strange.
Like an alien.
Like an alien. He didn't know, like, he couldn't engage correctly with everyday life. It's just very, very weird. But you do bring up an interesting point with the whole snafu principle in, you know, essentially saying, like, at a workplace, if it's structured in that way, then information gets distorted because information is never just a direct, you know, logical, this, you know, A plus B equals, you know, C. It's just you're trying to please somebody, so in a way that information can get distorted, you're trying to appeal to something instead of just stating the problem correctly, and it, you know, it may damage you or your reputation at work or whatever, but it can... at least you're being honest. That really is an interesting idea right there. Mm-hmm. Just kind of going back to the beginning, it does kind of seem like in the, you know, creative industries, there are a lot of problems, especially with, like, you know, people who work with you know, cameras and you know, people on a film set. Safety regulation has been a pretty big thing now, especially because this 27-year-old camera assistant in Atlanta got struck and killed by a train when she was working on a film set. And from what I understand, the film crew didn't have permission to be at the site filming. But they went ahead and did it anyway. They were fully aware of the safety issues there, but they got that woman to do it anyway. So, and didn't you say, like, you were talking earlier about, like, there was this one cameraman who, like, he was like a diver as well, and he swam out, and he like almost like his body just got like he was suffering from or he's like he was in danger of dying or something.
I don't know how I was talking about that.
Oh. Anyways, I don't know.
I mean, I guess, you know, certainly see that. And I mean, there's, you know, a history of that, you know, that's, you know, reoccurring in, I would say, you know, that's a common occurrence, I guess, through all manual labor. Because I had to go through, like, an OSHA course for this job that I had. And it's like, it was mainly showing how since OSHA regulations have been, you know, enforced, accidents have been dropping at a, you know, steady rate. But on the flip side, you know, when you have people working in, you know, it's like the film industry, where then it's like there's, I guess, that passion of, you know, wanting to pursue a creative, you know, it's like because one day, you know, hopefully you get to be the one calling the shots and then creating your vision. And so, and then, you know, even still, like, you know, just being a part of something that's, like, you know, doing, like, you know, something cool, like, you know, it's like they're on the train tracks, and then it's like, you know, that's probably like, hey, you know, this is cool, not everybody gets to be out here, and you're getting to do something that's different. And so it's tempting to do.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an allure to it.
There's an allure, there's a passion, there's this, you know, this idea of a starry-eyed, you know, upcoming young creative that
wants
to...
And then I think I remember, like, from the article, like, they had, I guess, had permission to be on the site, but not specifically the tracks. I think that's what it's called.
I think so, or
but
something
like
that.
I remember when we were at Dragon Con a couple years ago, there was, like, the film panel that we went and saw, and they were talking a lot about, like, guerrilla filming, where it's like, you know, you're just going somewhere and doing it yourself, and... it's like, you know,
that's cool to an extent, but if you know you're putting somebody in danger, and it's more if there's like a big budget involved,
mm-hmm.
you need to have proper regulations, because look what happened. Somebody got killed. Somebody was, and if somebody's going to die, there needs to be, like, you know, you need to kind of step back and say, you know, whoa, there needs to be more safety regulations. I'm talking about, because, you know, to a degree, guerrilla filmmaking and all that kind of stuff is pretty cool, but if it's done on, like, an individual type...
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, like, you know, I guess on that level, like, you know, you're working without any safety net.
Exactly.
Like, you know what you're getting into, but these people, you know, they may not have known, like, because they, you know, this was a legitimate, you know, film. They had permission to be on site, but not the tracks, and so maybe they thought they could have been there, too. It's like, either somebody didn't do their job, or somebody, you know, saw and just, like, assumed that, oh, well, you know, there's not going to be anything, and, you know, they didn't think it through.
I think, like, one of the Allman Brothers came up and said that they didn't want the film to be made, because it was a film about the Allman Brothers, but the other issue that I was talking about that, like, happened a while ago is, like, some filmmaker, like, had to go out swimming for, like, this one shot and, like, almost, you know, got, like, you know, hypothermia. I remember somebody was talking about that. I don't know who that was or for what film that was. It'd be interesting to find out, but it's the idea of, you know, somebody putting themselves in a very, very dangerous situation to get the shot, and it's... I can understand if that's done for, like, journalism or anything or something like that, where people are going into, like, real things that are happening, real, you know, catastrophes.
You
can't control a war zone. So that's, you know, people know that they're putting themselves, but, like, for film, this is fantasy, you know, this is construction, creation. To an extent, you could say that, you know, war is a type of construction, but I'm not gonna go there just yet. Well, that's later, but...
a different layer of the onion.
There's a fine line between journalism and
that,
so obviously that probably doesn't need to be stated, but to an extent I think it does. I don't know. But yeah, do you want to say something?
I just thought of a couple of instances where there's been accidents on set, but it's all been, I guess, involving actors that have died on set during filming. Well, there's the Twilight Zone movie that there's a helicopter crash that killed, like, you know, two child actors and you know, an adult actor, and that was like a really big deal. And then Bruce Lee, he got shot on set. And then whoever, the actor that played The Crow, it was like, I think he got shot on film set of that movie or the sequel or something. So, but yeah, I mean, those are all actors. Those are, you know, people whose names you're used to seeing. I have no clue how many, you know, people behind the scenes who have, you know.
Right. And I mean, it's not just like this kind of stuff just happens on like film sets or whatever. It's just, it seems more notable. I mean, like it could happen at an office, you know, somebody could be trying to plug something in and, you know, get a shock and that's it for them.
But, well, again, like I was saying, there's, you know, the construction industry is, like, with the OSHA stuff, it was showing just, like, yeah, how many people die from falls, how many people die from being caught in something, how many people die from, you know, being electrocuted, you know, all sorts of different stuff like that. And, but again, like, it's like, when you're on a construction site, there's personal protection gear that you gotta wear, and there's, like, there's supposed to be a code of safety that, or a culture of safety that is supposed to be, you know, on the job site, and that varies from job site to job site. Some, you know, it's like everybody's always wearing everything, and then there, I've been on some where it's like nobody's wearing anything, and then again, like, you know, people see me come around, they don't know who I am. I got a clipboard and a camera. They pop stuff on when they see me come by, but again, there's like, you know, an assumed risk. Like, you know, you know, and you try to prepare, and yeah, there's supposed to be this culture of safety. And you know, I don't know if on you know, film or, you know, crew or films productions, that if there is that level or you know, of enforcement.
There's you know what a PA is, like a production assistant, like for a crew. It's like, you know, a low level, you know, job for people who are entry level. You know, the you know, the that kind of work is, you know, low paying, long hours, you know, kind of the stuff that we used to do, you know, working.
And that was another thing about where we used to work, is there was the opposite of a culture of safety. There was like a culture of danger. It's like, you know, how can you push a little bit further and, you know,
exactly. It's like, come on, you know, push, go. Get up on the lift and not get tied.
Get
as high as you can, which is really dangerous. And
you're never supposed to take your feet off of the floor of it.
I remember I was up there, and we were like, had it extended as like high as we can go to get to the roof or whatever, to hang lights or something. And it just like, I moved a little bit and it shook. And I was just like, oh my God. It's scary, but it'd be really bad if there was like a fire and like down there and you were up there, if, like, the lift were to catch on fire.
Descend into flames. I guess, like, going back to the snafu principle, though, I can see that, it's like, I think that's like, yeah, ubiquitous throughout industry or commerce, the economy, because we especially see, like, with, like, the Veterans Affairs scandal that's been going on, like, just, like, there's no accountability. People are just like, well, I'm going to fudge the numbers or the records to make it appear as though everything is meeting the status quo, because the image of the status quo is more important than what's actually going on.
And that's messed up. That really is messed up. But that's kind of where we're at right now in our economy.
And then, it could even be said, I guess, you know, it was like airliners. They could fly further around dangerous places, but instead, it's like, well, we can save money if we cut a little closer.
Exactly.
Literally cutting corners.
Exactly. From what I understand, Malaysia Airlines was one of the few, if not like one of the only ones, that was still flying over Ukraine. A lot of the other airliners weren't doing that because they knew it was a very dangerous area. They did it. They were like, okay, well, you know what? What's more, or what means more to us? You know, profit, you know, or human lives? This is the thing. We need to kind of get away from judging how good a society is by its productivity,
yeah.
rather than
that's like
what's more important: a society's productivity or the well-being of each and every individual. That's one major root of the problem right there is what we value. That's I've been reading about like the idea of like you know false necessity, and there was just one philosopher who I can't remember his name right now. But he pretty much says that like, you know, societies can be organized in various different ways. It's like this isn't the only way.
Yeah.
This isn't the only way. If somebody were to say that, well, there's got to be a fast food worker somewhere. There's got to be somebody mopping the floors. It's like, no, there isn't. Or it's like, well, somebody has to, you know, be doing this. There's got to be, you know, an engineer building. It's like, no, there isn't.
Somebody's got to wash the dishes. Somebody's got to drive the bus.
It's like, or why can't we just accept the fact that...
Wash your own dishes.
Or even, you know, getting to the point that, like, there's going to be a degree of waste that we're not going to get rid of. We're just going to have to deal with it because that's just the way nature is, you know? Part of it has to do with aesthetics, what we perceive as clean and good, and what we, you know... The way we view aesthetics is embedded within how a culture is set up or how a society is set up. And it's just these things that are presented as needs, as absolute needs, which are just literally just accidents and that happen a certain way. And they become rigid institutions and become just too powerful. But they can...
Too big to fail.
Well, I mean... We're so close to the brink of failure. We really are. And it's so easy for this to just all collapse at any moment. I don't think people realize that. I was going to say something else, but I forgot.
Like, you know, I certainly feel that too. And, you know, I guess it's hard for me sometimes or to place where that feel is coming from.
Oh, what?
It's like... For this like sort of brink of collapse, because you know part of me wants to think that like well every generation feels that or like everybody always feels that because nobody never knows the future and there's always people predicting like an end date at some point, but
yeah that is true too, that's valid.
But you know I guess on the flip side it's like that still doesn't discount the fact that we have documented proof that what we're doing is affecting the world on a global scale, like, you know, the environment, the atmosphere, and that this can't be good, and, you know, yeah, gotta do something to...
The thing is, like, it's not like an eventual collapse will be a bad thing. The good thing is, that's saying that, like, things can't continue to grow. Things continue to grow.
Well, and then I guess that's, you know, it's all a matter of scale, and, because... It's like collapse wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It'd be a chance to restructure. But then I guess, you know, when the Soviet Union came along, that was a chance to restructure. And a lot of people didn't make it through that restructuring. You know, so if the restructuring came about through natural means, I think a lot less people would make it through. Because nature is a much harsher DM than most people.
It's kind of hard to compete against that, though. You know, I mean, in the end, it's just gonna, you know, things are just gonna happen in a certain way. It's kind of hard to go against the flow of, you know, time. Right? How? I mean, I don't know.
And then I guess, like, you know, I'm always fascinated by just how like linguistics. Language, how it affects how we perceive everything.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, the language that, you know, people use that they don't even think about. And it's like, and it's framing a certain perspective. And it's just, yeah, everywhere. I guess I'm just going to try to list a couple examples of that.
What, just how language shapes our reality?
Yeah.
And how ideology shapes our reality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to bring up a really kind of a dumb example, but this is, it's actually kind of interesting. It's like, one of the things that doesn't get standardized in a lot of cultures is how people use the restroom, or it's like how bathrooms are set up. It's like those. That's one thing that doesn't get standardized, and I think like the philosopher Zizek was saying that is like kind of indicative of how different cultures, you know, perceive like what they do with their waste. I mean, it's a natural process. It's crude, but it's just as important as anything else. Mm-hmm. So it's saying that like they're, you know, in Greece bathrooms are built differently. Here bathrooms are built differently. I think, you know, in a lot of places it's completely normal not to sit on anything, but to just kind of squat and just do your business. And I mean, a lot of that sounds very crude, but, you know, what makes it crude, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a natural process. It's as natural as eating. It's as natural as, you know, having sex.
Happening right now.
Exactly. I don't know how that exactly ties into what we were talking about, but it's interesting how different ideas shape the way we form reality. By creating bathrooms. But on a more... I don't know. What's a more poignant note than bathrooms? But... I know of one. You posted an article recently that was saying that like a lot of schizophrenics, depending on the culture that they're raised in, will influence the tone of the voice. A lot of Americans who are schizophrenics view the voice in their heads as being very harsh and critical, whereas people who are grown up in like Indian cultures tend to view the voices as more kind of playful and good. I think that kind of has a lot to do with this, the culture that they're embedded in. That's how ideas can shape, you know, your subjective reality.
Yeah, I guess that is a clear example of that relation. So I guess just going, like, you know, to, like, Terence McKenna's idea that, like, the, you know, people who have schizophrenic tendencies make, you know, are, like, chosen shamans in cultures that practice that. And that, you know, I guess lends to that idea as well, because, you know, if you're in a culture that embraces this this happening and it incorporates it into identity and society, then it's going to express itself differently than in one that doesn't allow for that expression and doesn't accept that as something that's supposed to happen.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. That was a pretty good point right there. Another thing is, like, we're seeing a resurgence of older ideas now in our society. It's like we're realizing that, okay, Western capitalism isn't working. Let's kind of revisit some of these older ideas that were, you know, practiced by, like, you know, South American shamans in the jungle and drinking their ayahuasca and participating in ritual, and Terence McKenna called it the archaic revival. Which there does seem to be a type of archaic revival.
Well, and, you know, this is something I guess I've heard, you know, people on other podcasts talking about, but just like, it's something I've talked about on mine as well, but like, our Western culture, what if there's such a lack of coming-of-age rituals, meaningful coming-of-age rituals?
Yeah, like there's the graduation. That's
like
about it.
Turning 21, you're able to drink. Or like 16, and you know, you're able to, you know, get your driver's license. Just like things that don't really aren't very, like, there's no like big celebration of like congratulations, like you've now crossed that line.
Because we've destroyed what that line is with our language. We've completely made it just subjective and relative.
And you know, like, every part of our lives is just, like, so compartmentalized and abstracted, and, you know, we're compulsory schooling, 40-hour-a-week jobs, if, you know, or more than that.
Exactly, and that's
like everything's just torn apart.
Exactly, and like that's exactly what I was saying about, like, you know, what with TaskRabbit and everything, and how it's taking these very trivial, meaningless things and it's saying, okay, let's figure out a way how to capitalize on this and get people to do it. That's like, you know, okay, hey, people think they may be solving the crisis of unemployment, but they're just laying down more trivial and meaningless things. It's not attacking the root of the problem, which is like one of them, which is what we were saying, is that this, you know, that false need.
I wonder if you could, like, run a social experiment through TaskRabbit, like, seeing sort of... I wouldn't want to say, like, you know, like... Because I could see how that, I guess, would come off a bit exploitative, but, you know, I guess try to steer clear of that, but, like, I don't know, see, like, what, like, people are willing to do or how it affects, like, what they do and, like, the environment that they're doing it in. Like, I guess, I don't know.
I get what you're saying, yeah. What would be the overall goal of something like that, though? Like, be like a, just kind of see how far people can go, in a way?
Or I just see, like, how that is, you know, affecting the person. Like, how doing this sort of, you know, like, I guess providing a typical, you know, setup that you know, somebody would encounter.
How it's affecting
being
the person.
Monitoring that.
That's interesting. You know, I was listening to NPR earlier today, and did you happen to listen to them talking about, like, the, like, kind of, like, this resurgence of, like, or, like, you know, doctors that come to your home or whatever? It's like...
No, I didn't hear that.
There was this... a little bit of talking about how, like, they're more like, you know, I guess, what do you call them, like, what's the...
House calls?
House call doctors or whatever. That's starting to happen a little bit more, and doctors are saying that that's probably a good thing, because you're not only getting to come to their home, but what you're able to see is their living conditions.
Yeah.
You're able to get a good intimacy with them. It's mm-hmm. like, they were talking about, like, you can see what they eat. So you could say, like, oh, you're eating too much dairy, or you can see that, like, oh, you know, something in your living condition may not be right. You develop a more intimate connection with them, and that gets, you know, put into the diagnosis, which can, it's different than, you know, them coming to the hospital. I mean, there's
like, was that more of like a, I guess, a high-end sort of, like, I mean, with standard insurance cover house call, or?
I don't know.
That's interesting. It seems like that it seems to me like it would cost a lot more to have the doctor come to you.
You know, probably, but I don't know. I don't know.
But that's not an argument against that sort of relationship with your doctor.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
That's certainly better than, like, the doc-in-the-box model, where, like, they're seeing as many people as they can throughout the day.
Yeah, house call doctors, you know, they're just able to get a look into what their living conditions are like. That's a more intimate connection. And also they were talking about, like, having the house call doctor, but also, like, with them having, you know, other trained specialists that can, like, literally come in and, like, be a Skype or something.
Well,
and,
yeah. If they got an iPad or something like that with them, then, yeah, they can bring anybody else
mm-hmm.
with them,
mm-hmm.
a team of specialists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's good. And, like, the doctors on there that they were interviewing were talking about, like, how, you know, went to go see the patient and ended up just, like, having dinner with them. Getting comfortable with your doctor, I think, is probably pretty, it's a lot better. I don't know.
Well, and then, I guess I just thought of the reverse of how that could be a bad thing, and then we got this cicada that's chirping in.
Uh-oh.
But yeah, like, because on the one hand, it's like, you know, you've got, you know, the more personal relationship with your doctor, but then I started thinking, like, well, you know, doctors, you know, like, they have you know, pharmaceutical industry and the, you know, the medical industry at large, just, like, you know, pressuring them to try to prescribe certain drugs or sell certain, you know, procedures.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so if, like, you know, you're, you know, that's the... if they're seeing themselves as a marketer as well as a doctor, then the dinner conversation would be when they would make that sell. Like, it's like, you really need to get that hemp replacement, Mrs. you know, Carnegie or whatever.
Mrs. Carnegie, thank you for the steak and potatoes. Right. So, the major roots of the problem. Okay. So what are some major roots of the problem?
Mm.
We've kind of jumped all over the place here. I think that the general theme of the conversation has been just, you know, the state of, you know, the transformation of this economy.
Yeah.
So, what are some
alienation?
Okay. That. What do you mean by that? Like, how? So.
Like I had mentioned earlier, with a society of the spectacle and the idea that, you know, the idea of capitalism where entrepreneurs come in is like they try to find something that is somebody's not making money off of it yet, and then they figure out how to make money off of it.
Right.
And it's like, how do I take some sort of organic relationship and you know, cut it up, package it, and then sell it, you know, steady units. And that's obviously like, you know, and again, like you, what you had said earlier about, we've not yet found a better model to, or there has not been a model implemented.
Nobody's proposing a solution,
yeah.
A real solution.
And so people who, you know, do want to change the world in a meaningful way are having to go through this roundabout way of like, well, I've got to get myself on top before I can help the other people.
The thing is, it's like, nobody's taking a non-materialist approach to life seriously. It's like, that's a pretty, you know, that's a way you can actively structure your life. It's not, you know, in a materialist way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can value things in a non-materialist way.
But that doesn't grow the economy.
It doesn't grow the economy, but what that does is it grows your sense of, you know, the sense of yourself, your individual, feel a lot better. That's what needs to be important rather than, yeah.
Another route, you know, would be, like viewing productivity as like the key indicator of health of a people or
right.
A country, a nation, whatever.
Right. Which is why another issue, and it's not, this isn't necessarily a problem, but it's causing a lot of problems, is automation.
Mm-hmm.
Automation is kind of what's creating a lot of these like low-end jobs, you know, because
mm-hmm.
people still need to work. Obviously, we can't implement a system of basic income. People still need to work. Yeah.
It's like, you know, first thing I thought of, I guess, would be like Jacob's Ladder, where it's like, you know, there's this change coming, and as long as you're fighting against it, it's going to seem like hell. But if you find a way to be okay and to flow with it and to adapt and become one, you're gonna be all right. You can't stop change. I read an interesting article earlier today. It was like, I think it's some museum in London or Europe that's got an exhibit on how, like, protests and certain items or artifacts from protests and how they've like shaped the world, because there's, you know, I guess they make the point there's all these exhibits that say like how it's like this design or certain, like, you know, certain something changed the world or changed how we viewed this, you know, construct. And yeah, I was just giving several examples, and they were saying like all these examples are coming from the left. Like, there's no examples of like far-right protest groups coming up with innovative new ways to express and, like, tactics to circumvent the police. Like, they, you know, they resort to the same old tried and true, well, let's just bash into them and, like, you know, the stronger ones will prevail. It's like, no, let's change the context of the conversation and then turn their strength into a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think that, I agree with a lot of what Occupy Wall Street stood for. However, the main problem with it was, I think, that it just kind of happened too quickly. It's like people were calling for action when
it was like
a
flash flood. It didn't. It wasn't sustainable.
Exactly, which is why I think people need to kind of just think. Like, now is the time to be just engaging in dialogue and thinking, because when you look at a lot of other political movements in the past, they didn't have the internet.
Yeah. Well, I would like to think that what Occupy was is sort of like a tremor. You know, it's just like a taste of what's going to eventually come back.
But part of what I was reading about, like, you know, the whole social theory of false necessity is saying that we could stop at any time. Like, we don't have to necessarily engage in rebellion against the social order. We could stop that at any time and just say, hey, you know, we could make it irrelevant by just building our own. Interrupt that and just kind of build. And see, that's an interesting theory to me. That we can fight back
like
by
a
just
breakaway society, or
yeah, in a way, a breakaway society, and a breakaway society that values different things.
Well, I think that I guess has been tried in the past and in various contexts, and it seems more often than not that they fail because of outside forces. Because, you know, if other people wake up to the idea that the way you're doing it now is not the only way, that it, you know, there are other ways, then that ruins their business model, because it's, you know, dependent upon people not having the option to choose something else.
Right.
So yeah, I would simply parry that, like, they would try to, I guess, you know, like, Cuba would be an example. It's like, they was like, no, we're gonna be communists right here in the Gulf of Mexico. And so, trade embargo.
I mean, it doesn't mean that you're not going to have to deal with some sort of resistance. I mean, you're still going to have to stand up. I mean, like, not everything is going to be just, you know, feeling good. I mean, like, mm-hmm. We're not here just
well, I mean,
to just.
And then again, Cuba's still standing, so it's like, that's not failed. Like, you know, the way they tried to market.
But I mean, this society is failing. Look at it. It's failing. Turn on the television and see what it's trying to put out. It's
like,
awful.
Like a dandelion has failed because it's wilted after, you know, growing through a crack in the sidewalk. It's like, no, it managed to grow and spread its seed. That's the meaning of life,
right,
on a genetic level.
So I think at this point we need to kind of look at all of these, you know, emancipatory solutions that are happening right now and engage in that. Through dialogue. Basic income is something that should be fought for, is something that needs to be fought for, because it's more of a direct solution through because of all this automation that we're facing. And it's way more of a direct solution than, you know, trying to create more menial tasks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I think what that's saying is something with, like, basic income, and obviously, you know, I'm no expert on it, but it's just saying that we're inheritors to,
well,
all of this.
Here's an interesting idea.
Okay.
All right, so, you know, if we continue to have these advances in computer sciences, and then we get to be able to run more and more realistic simulations of the world, or just, like, you know, systems in general, you know, you could simulate, like, an economic system, like ours. And then, you know, be able to toy with it and say, like, well, what happens if we make this sort of change? And get, like, you know, different models on how, you know, or, you know, implementing entirely new models altogether, and how, you know, to transition, we can figure out mathematically what's the most likely way that we can transition from one model to another, if, mm-hmm. you know, or if displacement is, you know, like, what are the people who get caught in between going to do?
Mm-hmm. What do you think about a barter type economy?
I like the idea of it.
I like the idea too. Birmingham Free Traders, you heard of them? They do that kind of stuff. Because it's saying, like, I have this, you have this, trade. Or it's, you know, I have a skill, do something, trade. It's leveling the playing field rather than, you know, one person having no leverage against another, like, you know, TaskRabbit. Mm-hmm. And the TaskRabbits don't necessarily have proper leverage against the, you know, the other side. With trading, you're not necessarily commodifying any labor. You're taking into account all this junk and saying, hey, you know, maybe we could try to figure out a new way to do something with it instead of just, you know, I don't know.
No, yeah, I think, you know, the more ways you can figure out how to eliminate money out of your transactions,
yeah,
the better.
The better. Well, where does that leave Bitcoin? Bitcoin kind of, there are some things that I'm just a little, you know, apprehensive about it, because
mm-hmm.
It has a pretty big following from a lot of anarcho-capitalists.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that you know, not the most favorable crowd in my opinion. But
It's like they're treating it, a lot of like people who do it like for real are treating it as like ushering in a new age of like, and I mean, I think that there's probably going to be more cryptocurrency, like, you know, more prevalence in the future, obviously, because if, you know, tech...
Well, I mean, I think any technology has the potential to be used in a good or bad way, or in a way that is helpful to the human condition and harmful, and, you know, I guess, you know, this technology seems like it has that the potential to be transformative in a positive manner, but then there's also the capacity for it to transform in a negative way as well. It's just, you know, who is controlling it and, you know, how society receives it. And, but yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, the internet's giving us this ability now to have all these microcosms, like setting up these petri dishes where experiments can be played out. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, which is like, you know, perhaps in the future we could just have these, you know, simulations, like entire, like, you know, networks simulated to see how that would, you know, so rather than having to take a slice of the real world and try that out, we could just make it entirely virtual.
It's interesting when you say that, because that's putting a more mathematical spin on things, which I like that idea, but... You look at now, like, you know, Wall Street stock traders or whatever, I'm almost, like, I'm willing to bet that there's a lot of, like, major economic decisions made from just, like, intuitive kind of, like, or, like, kind of like a horoscope or whatever. Yeah. I think, like, I heard that Reagan or whatever got his horoscope read or something like that, or it was just, like, I mean, there's a lot of... I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of economic decisions are made based off of some sort of intuitive, religious, or supernatural thing. And I think that's something that we need to eliminate. We need to become more, way more mathematical. And
I think, you know, one possible way to perhaps, you know, sort of reflect or, you know, might complain that that notion would be from just like that idea of the self-made person. And it's like, you know, it's my, you know, determination. It's my, like, you know, skills and abilities. It's my, like, you know, thought patterns that have led me here.
Yeah.
And so, of course, like, when I make this call, it's going to be right because...
Right. Yeah. It's weird. What was I going to say? I was going to say something. Oh, right. Earlier, we were talking about how, like, you know, like the idea of the starry-eyed idealist going in, but in a sense that's kind of a trap for them because they take somebody who's so ambitious and willing, and you'll have somebody who's easily who's an easy vulnerable target for being exploited. So I think now, I think being skeptical and cynical to a degree is an absolute necessity.
Well, it's certainly, I guess, you know. It's not going to do you any harm to at least reflect on those ideas. You don't have to act on them, but at least think them out and you know.
And directly communicate with people.
Yeah.
Directly, like, even if it's just going to come off as, like, you know, I guess snappy or whatever. I don't, that's a bad word, but, like, you know, just directly communicate. Don't get into the, what was it? You mentioned it earlier.
Snafu
principle. Yeah,
don't give in.
Don't give in to that. Don't.
You gotta tell it like it is. Because at the end of the day, that's you that's gotta deal with it.
And it's like, the employer says, "I like you. You know, you got a good head on your shoulders. You tell it like how it is. I'm gonna, you know, offer you a promotion or something." Then you get caught into the trap more.
That's how it goes.
Even a statement like that, that's how it goes. It's like, well, it can go in a lot of other ways. So talk about false necessity. How language shapes our idea of where we are. I don't know.
Sort of tangent, but, you know, sort of related. I guess, like, I don't know if this is, I feel like this is a Southern thing, I don't know, but it's like, yeah, somebody, how their day is going, it's like, oh, it's good, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, like that idea, it's like, it's always good. It's like,
nobody says that, oh man, I'm having a really bad day, or like.
I've had a couple people this week, and it was weird, like this week in particular, I've had a couple people tell me, it's like, oh, I'm above ground.
The mail, or like, I went to go, like, deliver a letter, this was a long time ago, but I went to go, like, mail something off or whatever, and like there was this, like, you know, worker behind the counter, and somebody asked him, he's like, how you doing? He's like, I'm above dirt. And he just like said that. I was like, that was just, that came out of his mouth, and like something about the guy, like, you know, working for the government, you know, working like a mail mail officer or whatever, work behind the counter, and just saying that like with such like vigor and vitality. I really like that.
Oh, wait, so he said it in, like, with a positive inflection, or...
No, it just kind of sounded like... I mean, there's obviously a degree of cynicism when somebody says that, yeah. But he said it in a way that was just... He didn't say it, like, above dirt, like he was depressed. He said it like he was alive.
Yeah.
Like, he was alive, like, I'm above dirt. Like,
because that's how, I guess, like, you know, the people that I talk to, that's how they express it as well. It's like,
it's like...
So it's like, acknowledging the fact that, you know, it's like, you don't have the best plight. Like, you know, it's hot.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of stuff to do. But, you know, it's, you know, acknowledging...
It feels good to just say that, to get a little angry sometimes. I mean, like... You know, you don't want to literally go postal. That's not, like, a way to kind of counteract that. It's just, like, being completely honest. That's like, you know, going back to, like, gone into Buddhism or whatever, when they talk about being compassionate. It's not always being all, like, you know, nice and flowery. It's literally being in tune with, like, how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't feel good all the time.
Yeah, so you're doing a disservice to yourself and others by, you know, being deceitful.
Right.
You know, putting on a false face.
Yeah, and it's like, it's not always going to be feeling good. That's not what life is, obviously not. You're going to have to engage in a degree of suffering, but yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think we kind of went over, like, I wrote down, like, the three major roots of the problem that I want to talk about. One of them was, like, you know, talking about, you know, how what we value, and then the other was automation and how that's a byproduct. The last one that we didn't really touch on, but is kind of, you know, self-evident, is just inequality.
Mm-hmm.
On all of wealth, of class, race, all that.
Yeah.
What do we do? How do we, the society does tend to kind of marginalize a lot of other people out there. Like, you know, people who are homeless, who are sick. What are they going to do? What's their benefit to this society? You know, if you have something that just its worth is based off its productivity, then there's going to be a lot of people that are left out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's all.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I guess society doesn't acknowledge the fact that, like, you know, somebody is a relative or a role model to somebody else. That sort of stuff isn't quantified. And tallied and taken into the gross national product.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's unfortunate.
Any closing remarks? I think we've kind of...
Gotta be the change.
Oh. Okay. I got some change in my pocket. And that's all we got for you today. So, remember, if somebody asks you how you're feeling today, just tell them how you really feel. Just try it. Just as an experiment. Well, until next time, see ya.